Good evening, everyone. Happy New Year. Thanks for tuning in to Tribal Theocrat Live. Today is January 5th, 2013. My name is Christian Gray. Tribal Theocrat Live deals mostly with taboo issues that affect our people and our faith. You can visit our audio archives at tribaltheocrat.com to hear provocative and informative interviews with various guests on such topics as Talmudism, law enforcement problems, our police state, bad homeschooling trends, multiculturalism, and much more. Also, please remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll announce future shows, usually first on those channels. We are lining up guests as we speak in the near future to deal with topics such as a Christian view of firearms and self-defense. Mickey Henry will be discussing that. The dark side of post-military life, the case for the South and the old Confederacy, Christian identity theology, and much more. Stay tuned for details. And also please note that our next show will be this coming Monday, January 7th at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. My guest will be John Friend, who's a West Coaster, and we've had to push the show back an hour and move the date a bit to accommodate his schedule. There will still be a show on the usual third Saturday of this month, the 19th. I'll be joined on that show by co-host Scott Terry to review and discuss current events from a Christian worldview. But tonight, we're discussing a new topic with a new guest. And if you want to participate, join the chat room at tribaltheocrat.com, and we'll field your questions as we move through our subtopics. And on the line now to discuss National Socialism and the Third Reich is Tom Hengist, who writes for firstword.us. At your blog, Tom, one can find book reviews, movie reviews, articles on history and ethics and theology and current events. Talk about how you got started with your blog and what's the goal at firstword.us.
Well, me and my colleague have been discussing current issues and philosophical and theological issues since probably the mid-90s, often over the phone, but whenever we could get together. So when blogging became the thing in 2006, I just decided to start this and put some of our thoughts down to basically to not so much as to be the answer man, so much as to open up discussion, hoping that we'd get discussion and wider exposure to some ideas and, you know, get other people to contribute and show us where we're wrong and have it a two-way street. It's a Christian website focusing on tipping over some of the sacred cows of modern politics, especially, you might say, red state politics, and especially when those viewpoints are put forth by Christians. We are Vantillians under the strong influence of Wittgenstein. So I think it's a pretty unique perspective, and that's why we keep plugging away.
Well, I've really enjoyed it. Some of my favorites were your article entitled Lincoln, A Brief Introduction. That helped open my eyes to that war, and your series on Ken Ham is a big favorite from those I talk to who know your blog, and you've got so many good things there, so thanks for doing that. And just for the record, it was your blog, I believe, that helped me come about my awakening, as it were, and reading
so great to hear stories like that.
It's, sure.
Our readers are few compared with, you know, the big ones, but nevertheless, I think they're high quality.
As we talk about National Socialism today and the Third Reich, what's the background for your interest in these topics?
Well, to start with, you know, I've always been interested in Germany and things German since high school, probably because I, due to my family heritage. So in high school, I took, you know, a couple of years of German, and then when I got to college, I continued to take as many classes in German as my schedule would permit. And so forth. But, you know, there was always that blemish on, you know, the history of Germany is a great one, going back to the Roman Empire times, described by Tacitus, for example. But then there was this, you know, blemish, you know, in the history of the 1930s, the Third Reich, Hitler, and so forth. So at the time, I was a radical von Mises libertarian, and I followed, as a good libertarian, I followed the model of portraying fascism as another form of collectivism with communism. And so, you know, with a shrug of the shoulders, you just say, well, you know, everybody gets tempted by collectivism at some point, and fascism, communism, at most, you know, discussing with friends, if if the subject came up, I might point out that, yeah, Hitler was bad, but Stalin was even worse, and that kind of thing. So, but at the same time, at that time, I was also a theonomist, and Rushduni had mentioned that, you know, the amount number of Jews that were killed in World War II was probably a tenth of the 6 million, like more like 600,000 or something.
Right.
And I just kind of bookmarked that. That just became kind of a troubling theme in the back of my mind that didn't change my rhetoric at all, but it was kind of like there as a meme waiting to explode. So, you know, as time went by in the 90s, I discovered the Southern Agrarians, and then slowly that led to a deepening of the roots to where I slowly came to kind of a tribalist view of world history. And that was exciting because suddenly world history opened up, made sense. You know, all of a sudden you can understand the motion of nations and so forth, where the non-tribal view really can't account for world history, I don't think. So that was exciting. But then that raised the whole Jewish question because, you know, the Jewish presence in our country and other countries is not our tribe, it's a different tribe. And I was also discovered Michael Hoffman in the early 2000s, and his whole unmasking of what he calls the cryptocracy. And he was also dropping these Holocaust revisionism memes and so forth. So, you know, so that was sort of brewing in the background also. And so finally, all of these threads kind of converged, and I had to kind of hold my breath and decide to look into the matter a bit because, you know, all of a sudden you had National Socialism, which was tribalism par excellence, and then you had the whole Jewish question involved with that. And, you know, so, but, you know, as you know, to give up the Holocaust view, for example, is to make yourself more of a pariah than if you give up Christianity.
I mean, yes.
You run more of a risk of, you know, losing friends, losing your job even, your family either disowning you or at least kind of acting like you're the crazy uncle around the table. So it's a pretty tough rock to even work up the courage to turn over. But I finally did. And I started doing some readings just over the last 5 or 6 years. Well, the rest we'll probably get into in detail.
Yes. Speaking of Rushduni's claim about the reduced numbers of the Holocaust, I remember when I first became involved in reading Reconstructionist literature and theonomic literature, I was really excited about it, and a guy at my church caught wind of it, and he was one of those heresy hunter types, and he always carried this folder around, and I never knew what was in that folder, and one day he approached me and my friend, who was also a theonomist, and he pulls out his file on Rushduni, and he drops that quote on me. Hey, Rushduni had a view that was these numbers are quite inflated, and I didn't know what to think about it at the time. But that was his refutation of theonomy. If one of the leaders of it believes something that's not politically correct, then it must be false. So I won't forget that.
Well, yeah, that type of approach has continued to this day. Carl Truman, for example, of Westminster Seminary, you know, has published public blogs where he you know, accuses Rushduni of being unhinged, crazy,
right,
not worthy of paying any attention to just because of that fact. And yet the detailed argument never gets discussed. It's always just, you know, he's a heretic now.
Right. Wasn't he the one that said that the Holocaust is one of the most well-documented events in history?
I think he probably did. I know Steve Schlissel has also said that.
Okay, yeah.
It's a fairly common cliche now.
Right.
All the time.
Well, before we get into National Socialism proper, I want to bring up Hitler's buried success as a social builder. When most people think about the name Hitler, they do think immediately of the number 6 million, but they're not thinking of the 6 million unemployed German men that Hitler amazingly put back to work in a matter of a few years. Just how big of an accomplishment was that, and how much bigger of an accomplishment is it for the establishment to conceal this?
Well, it was a huge accomplishment, and we need to remember that during that same period, the United States was also in a deep depression with massive unemployment. And yet, Roosevelt's interventions did very little to cure the unemployment. My parents were teens and young adults during the 30s, and they said the economy didn't really improve until the war broke out. In contrast to that, Germany under National Socialism achieved full employment, and people from neighboring countries even would go to Germany to get better jobs. For example, my Austrian housekeeper, when I used to live somewhere else, was a young girl in Austria, and her father would commute all the way up to Germany. This is before the Anschluss, of course, to get a better job. And it's interesting, I just rewatched a BBC documentary called The Nazis, A Warning from History. And they interview a German economist named Johannes Zahn, who they identify him as economist and banker since 1931. I don't know exactly what that means, if he was since 1931 during National Socialism or since 1931 all the way up to the present. But in any case, he expresses surprise that he said that the economists, by their analysis, said that by 1938, this economic miracle that Hitler had pulled off should have resulted in massive inflation, but it didn't. He said they were all amazed and scratching their heads. So, you know, it would take a real economist to try to analyze the why and the wherefore, but of course, very few economists have the courage to really look into this matter in a deep way. It has to be granted that a lot of the employment was similar to what Roosevelt called works projects, but there was this key difference. Roosevelt's work projects were often just busy work, sometimes even just shoveling piles of dirt from one place to another, just so you could have men busy and justify giving them a paycheck. Hitler's work projects actually built things of value, such as the Autobahn. You know, the Autobahn was basically like our interstate highway system, but 20 years earlier.
A article that I read that I'll probably be quoting from periodically is one from, I think it's Leon DeGrelle, and I'll post a link in the chat room, called How Hitler Consolidated Power in Germany and Launched a Social Revolution. He points out that unlike Roosevelt, who had a mass supply of gold reserves, Hitler had close to nothing when he had to rebuild his country. And this is another buried fact. What about this massive suffering of the German people after World War I? Briefly discuss the scope of this suffering that Hitler faced as he took office.
Yeah, the 1920s was, of course, the roaring 20s for Americans, but it was a time of turmoil in Germany. You know, first of all, you had the World War I ended in 1919, I believe, abruptly. The soldiers themselves couldn't understand why it ended, because they felt like they were winning, and they already had won on the Eastern Front, actually. But suddenly it ended, and the country was thrown into chaos. Revolutionaries basically took over the government, exiled the Kaiser. Communists, almost entirely Jewish led, took over Bavaria and Munich and declared the Bavarian Social Republic. So you actually had one of the major states of Germany being taken over by communists who promised to attach it to the USSR. Now, the Freikorps, the basically volunteer German men, often veterans from the war, were able to march into Munich and defeat them. But you have to kind of imagine if this happened in, like, say, in Boston, you know, where communists literally took over the state government and then threatened to, you know, attach Massachusetts to a foreign alien country. So meanwhile, you know, the Weimar Republic, it was called, started to print up money to pay for their expenses and the reparations, creating this huge hyperinflation of the early 20s that's still talked about. Billions of marks being required just to buy a loaf of bread, for example. So it wiped out the middle class, basically. Their savings were completely wiped out. Then the French, even at that, the Germans were unable to meet the onerous Versailles Treaty reparations. And so then the French actually marched into the Rhineland and took it over. So the eastern part of the country was occupied by the French, who ruled with an iron hand, quote unquote. At the same time, the Jewish infiltration of their Hollywood, in other words, the Berlin scene, theater, films, entertainment, nightclubs, rose to its prominence with extreme decadence, the degradation of women, pornography, and so forth. Then, you know, to add insult to injury, toward the end of the decade, America had been loaning Germany money to pay for all of this. And then America called in the loans. So the house of cards just collapsed into complete widespread unemployment and misery. The BBC documentary says Germany became the worst hit nation in the world just when things couldn't get worse, they did. All five of the major banks collapsed and 20,000 businesses. So meanwhile, during this period, the communists were recruiting heavily, and it must have been quite a scene, because, you know, conservatives would get in arguments with communists, you know, in the cafes and whatnot or on the street, and it would break out into fights, fist fights, and with clubs. Mm-hmm. So throughout this time, you had basically, you know, public chaos taking place with open street fighting. When Hitler was finally made the chancellor in 1933 or 34, the documentary shows the Jew who was the son of the communist that took over Munich 15 years early, was saying that the communists were not very upset because they thought that Hitler's incompetence would bring him down, after which it would be their turn. Right. So from their point of view, it was just, you know, a power grab, that they wanted to be the ones grabbing the power. There was nothing principial in their objection. So when you put all these factors together, the rise of Hitler seems inevitable and even reasonable in view of the depredations.
Sure. I recall in my Western Civ class in college, there was a whole week devoted to the Holocaust, and he talked about the Treaty of Versailles and how it affected Germany and the poverty and how they were burning Deutschmarks to start fires and so forth. And my teacher said that Hitler blamed Jews for all their foul art, which he did, but the teacher never answers the question, was it true? Did the Jews really push that foul cultural art? Interesting how they don't get into the details. They just say Hitler believed this, this, this. The question is, well, was it true?
Well, yeah, I saw there's another documentary I saw it on Netflix streaming, and I don't remember the title, but I'll try to find it and post a link. But okay. It's basically a documentary of the three most decadent cities of the world of that time. And one of them was Singapore, China, and one was, I believe, Paris. I could be mistaken about that, but the third was Berlin. Hmm. And actually, the spin that the documentary gave was that it wasn't this great, you know, cosmopolitan, freewheeling. But, I mean, you didn't have to scratch very far below the skin to realize these were just cesspots of vice and sin, basically.
Right.
And Berlin was, you know, right at the vanguard of that.
Well, in addition to these factors that Hitler had to overcome, he also had to take power democratically and gain the support of many different groups. This, too, was no easy task, was it?
Right. He was obviously touching a nerve. I mean, his greatest achievement was defragmenting the right wing, in a sense. I mean, it does no good to have 25 parties with slightly varying agendas advocating for the same basic cause, because then your enemy is simply divide and conquer, as Hitler himself pointed out. Right. So, you know, the mainstream press shows that speech where Hitler deplores the existence of 30 different political parties and promising to eliminate that deplorable situation as proof that he was, you know, a totalitarian in his heart and so forth. Whereas when I see the same speech, it seems very reasonable that, you know, we can't keep going like this. We have to consolidate into ourselves as a people and get control of our own country again.
I see. Let's discuss National Socialism. If you're in the chat room and have any questions, then you can type those out. We'll get to those as we wrap up this subsection. National Socialism is another term that's misunderstood. What exactly is National Socialism, and specifically how it's distinct from socialism that we hear today?
Well, in their rhetoric, they were always against socialism used abstractly. So socialism just used by itself is generally a word used by communists to describe their agenda, whereas the National Socialists, it was always National Socialism, almost like one word. In fact, I guess in German, it actually is just one word. So it was a single word or concept. And in the very expression, we can see the difference from leftist socialism being clearly indicated. The difference between left and right socialism Well, we have to ask the question, are the libertarians right that these are just two flavors of socialism? What I finally realized, you know, pondering this, is that, no, that's not the case. National socialism, the emphasis should really be on national or nation. National socialism was a view of the nation where all classes of people are people and should be respected and given their rights and should all work for the common good as well as for their own personal advancement. Whereas communist socialism talks about the class, the abstract class of the workers, which is the same class throughout the world. It's international. So the international workers are to band together and rise up against their oppressive exploiters and so forth. They never ask what's going to happen when they become the ruling class, the oppressive exploiters. There's logical conundrums in the communist vision. But for the National Socialists, it was first and foremost a resurrection of the German people themselves, coming together. So the industrialists are not out to exploit the workers. The workers also are not trying to exploit, but they have their rights,
right,
and so forth. Now, as far as the socialism as an economic policy, of course, they did have the works projects. They did have the steering of the economy through, the military buildup and other things like that. So in that sense, it was very much like what you might say our parties both advocate. You know, it's kind of like a Republican Party in a sense, as far as their willingness to intervene in the economy. But the huge difference between both that would make them differ from both our Republicans and Democrats and communists on the other side would be that the goal being the prosperity of the German people.
Okay. So would that be the goal then? The essence of the National Socialist Party would be the prosperity of the German worker?
That's right, but not to the exclusion of the capitalist or the bourgeoisie. In other words, that all people in their proper place should prosper. But the German worker, in fact, did benefit tremendously under National Socialism. They suddenly were able to take vacations. There were beach resorts where, in fact, part of the motivation for building the Autobahn and creating the Volkswagen was so that workers would be able to take holidays out to the shore, the beach. And they still have these massive beaches that were set up in along the North Sea to this day that the workers went to. So, and they had the workers, got benefits, sick pay, vacation, pensions, things like that. Of course, that some of that goes back. There's a long history of that began with Bismarck. So in a sense, Germans were pioneers with many of these concepts predating the National Socialism, but it kind of took a new life at that point.
Most people think that Hitler was a pure dictator, yet he said, quote, "I am not a dictator. I never will be." He says democracy will be rigorously enforced by National Socialism. So many ask, how is it that Hitler could use totalitarian measures to transform the working class and yet not be a dictator?
Well, that's right. In this BBC documentary, which I really recommend to all of your listeners to get and watch, it's kind of amusing because several times throughout it, the narrator expresses amazement at how little control Hitler either exercised or said he wanted to exercise. In fact, they express amazement that he tended to be late rising from bed. He watched when he was at his resort, he watched a couple movies a day, took long walks. Even in his speeches, he was very vague as far as setting out any kind of agenda. So the picture that emerges is that what his role was kind of a galvanizing force to try to get the Germans to seize control of their own destiny. And they did, the narrator actually even goes so far as to say it almost seemed like a bottom-up totalitarianism, whatever that means.
Right. I want to read a quote from this article by Leon Degrelle. He says, "The people," Hitler declared, "were not put here on earth for the sake of the economy, and the economy doesn't exist for the sake of capital. On the contrary," and here's Hitler's view, "capital is meant to serve the economy, and the economy in turn to serve the people. So that might help clarify his key view there. I'm going to drop the link to this in the chat room, How Hitler Consolidated Power in Germany and Launched a Social Revolution by Leon Degrelle. Good article. A little bit long and a little bit of a nuance in there. For some reason, there's some words are hard to read. If you have a word that's hard to read, try inserting, I think it's ED in there. Have you read that article, Tom?
No.
Okay, yeah, you get to this certain words, and apparently it's an old article when someone formatted it. A couple characters got exported, but if you can generally figure out what the word's trying to mean.
Does it tend to happen at the end of the line?
Yeah, it's usually at the end, but sometimes in the middle. So, for example, the word amended is intended, but it comes out amend or something like that. So you just add the ED in a word that's weird, and you'll be able to figure it out. So please check out that if you're listening by podcast or live show. Was National Socialism, Tom, was it a success for post-World War I Germany only because of its unique time and place? Or is this a system that should be duplicated, one that can be reconciled with a biblical ethic? For example, Hitler's 1934 labor charter stated, quote, "The interest of the community may require that an incapable or unworthy employer be relieved of his duties." Now, this doesn't sound like the biblical free enterprise view. What do you make of that?
Well, in a deracinated society, when every man is for himself, is the operating principle, the working man is always going to be at a disadvantage compared to capital. You know, the horror stories that we've all heard of men working for 29 years and then being let go a year before getting a pension are real. And the libertarian will always come back and say, well, they should have made a contract making this impossible. You know, it's the answer to everything.
Right.
But such a contract is impossible. What good is a contract anyway if the company ups and moves to Taiwan? The working sap needs a job to support his family. And he doesn't understand the big picture and what goes on behind the scenes and the collusion of the big shots. So the patriarch / magistrate must ensure that the weaker parties are not taken advantage of. Now, in a healthy society, very little will be needed, as the owners will also have an eye for their fellow tribesmen that are working for them. And we've also seen many examples of that. I think, for example, in the Scandinavian countries today, industrialists will often describe the fact that they're not going to, they're going to do everything they can not to lay people off in a slump because, you know, the company is not just to make profit. It's also to provide work and to be part of the community and part of the national economy and so forth. So the question though, is when you have an unhealthy society such as ours is, and such as Germany in the 1930s was, or the 1920s leading up to 1930, are the rights of capital absolute because of the mantra of property, or is there a community aspect that must be enforced when it is abused? And I guess as I became less libertarian and more tribal, I opt now for the latter view.
Okay, let's pursue this a little bit more. On your blog, you've criticized theonomic libertarianism because it basically says that in this situation, you know, tough luck for the worker bees, with liberty comes risk and responsibility. Libertarians reject National Socialism because they believe that societies need zero central management because they're best run when all the interactions between the people are voluntary. And theonomists reject National Socialism because God hasn't authorized the magistrate to tinker with the economy. It's for this reason, the prevailing theonomic idea that the state can only act where God explicitly says it can, that you've called it theonomic libertarianism. What's ultimately wrong with theonomic libertarianism?
Well, it's a big subject. We could approach it from different angles. Okay. And, you know, maybe we'll want to pick one or two angles we could talk about, you know, the libertarians' concept of property, for example. And, you know, normally it seems like theonomic libertarians, as well as all libertarians, just take property as it currently exists as kind of a given. But then when they try to explain the origin of property, it becomes a lot more dicey. Another thread that we could talk about is the internationalism that's latent in any form of libertarianism. There's the question of whether scripture actually teaches libertarian theonomy. And I think it, in fact, doesn't. But I guess maybe one way that we could kind of like enter into the subject is more at the level of anecdote and natural authority relations. You know, I would say the denomination that most, it's called like the mecca of theonomic libertarianism is a split pea Presbyterian group called the RPCUS. And I was on a, I was being examined by a board of a small Christian college composed almost entirely of these men from RPCUS. And in the course of that examination, you know, the question came up, like if a girl wants to marry outside of her race and her father says no, what should she do? And to a man, these theonomic libertarians all said that, well, such a father would be exceeding his authority because scripture doesn't command that, and therefore the girl is free to do whatever she wants to do. Well, you see, this is just pure nonsense, because all of humankind from the beginning of our history and all of its manifestations that I know of have all affirmed that the father of the girl must give his permission and blessing before a marriage can take place. But these men, with just a wave of the hand, are willing to wave it aside with this view of scripture, the role of scripture that you just outlined.
Right.
But then what's odd about it is that, you know, the moderator of the group still admitted that, you know, he would have the right to not let her marry a convict, like say in jail or something. Well, where does the scripture say you can't do that? So they already kind of showed the self-contradiction. But even dig deeper though, I mean, there you have basically a model of authority where, like say, the father is nothing more than the Bible answer man. And if he gives an exegesis of scripture that the girl disagrees with, she can just ignore it. So in that sense, they should basically say that, you know, this is a ritual. Asking the father of the bride for her hand in marriage is just an empty ritual. Or if it has any sense at all, you could pick to go to either the father or, like, say, the president of Westminster Seminary and ask them for to exegete the law of God to see if this marriage is lawful or not.
Right.
That's what it all kind of boils down to. So to me, the absurdity of theonomic libertarianism was brought out just in that that simple little story.
That does make sense. I know that on your blog you've written about a parallel. You've got the fifth commandment, and it does allow for extra biblical enforcements, not contrary biblical. But so are you suggesting that, because the Westminster Confession of Faith, for example, in chapter 23 says that a magistrate is a nursing father with a duty to protect his people. You've written that magistrates are also called shepherds or ministers of God in Romans 13. Is this the parallel? Because we see a father can do this over the family, then a magistrate can use the same principle over his people.
Well, that's right. And so, I mean, I guess the criticism that we have of that perspective is that it's not so much that they're bad exegetes, so much as they're not even human. They're subhuman when they start taking that point of view, because there are certain constraints of human life that we presuppose, which are ratified by scripture, but not spelled out. For example, the blessing given on a marriage. Now, when we go to the civil realm, it's the same way. A strict libertarian, like my mentor, Dr. Bonson, was, for example, we raised the question, you know, if somebody buys 500 acres, you know, across the street from your housing development and decides he's going to build an airport there with jetliners flying in and out, would that be okay? And you know, to his credit, he was at least consistent with his own views, and he said, yes, that would be perfectly fine. But again, this is insane, because, you know, when I bought my house there, if I did, it would be with the assumption that you're not going to have airplanes flying overhead.
Right.
And so it seems to me that there's a communal aspect of property ownership. Granted, you are entrusted with that property, and you have a great deal of authority over your property, but that authority is not absolute. It still has to be modified by the needs of the community to some extent. And so, yes, when you have a king, model of the king as the exemplar of the people, he has to be able to step in and say, this is not an acceptable use of the property. Or you could also imagine, like, say, take one of those charming German towns, and we used to have a few charming ones too in early America. Some alien comes in and wants to build a monstrosity high-rise, twisted metal and glass thing right in the middle of this charming little wood frame village. Does he have the right to do that? Well, as a libertarian, we had to say, yes, he has the right to do that because property is everything. Okay. But now I see that the individual, we aren't just marbles rattling around in a bag. We're part of a community. And there are some rights that the community has for how property is used. Now, of course, that has manifested itself in our country through zoning regulations and so forth. But the problem with the zoning that we have is that, again, we've lost our tribal roots. And so zoning now just becomes a battleground for competing interests. And so you have, you know, the guy that wants to build the ugly Walmart downtown, and he's opposed by someone else that wants to do something else. But we're lacking that view of what society should be. And we need, therefore, the magistrate as the nursing father, as you mentioned, who is in it for the total nation, the total people.
Yeah, the question that comes to me, because I tend to be a strong decentralist, is, and even Bonson would say things like, if the magistrate isn't limited to what's explicitly in Scripture, then what's to keep him from doing whatever he wants to do? So the question is, what are the proper limits of a national socialist, or forget that term, just a, what are the limits of a magistrate? Because we've got a number of capital crimes in the Scripture. Can he institute new capital crimes? Should he tinker with the economy and welfare and Social Security? How do we limit him, Tom?
Well, you know, even Calvin suggested that the magistrate could even impose the death penalty for certain crimes that a people needs that barrier to be set up because they're prone to it. I mean, for example, think of the death by hanging given to horse thieves in the Wild West in our country. I think that's an entirely appropriate remedy because of the serious threat to life and limb that would be right. entailed by losing your horse out in the middle of the wilderness. Right. So there you have an adaptation to the local circumstance, which would be completely missing the point to come back and say, well, Leviticus says that theft should only be fourfold restitution. So I should just get four horses. Well, no, because a horse thief is threatening the whole community, and it has to be dealt with in a very severe manner. Now, not necessarily permanently. Then after the West became settled and had railroads and so forth, then you would relax that type of penalty. So the question is, you know, how do we prevent abuse, I think, is maybe the nub of your question.
Right. That is the nub of it.
There, I think that at the end of the day, if people are a slavish people, they will attract tyrants. So in other words, if we become like a peasant slavish people, like say the modern Egyptians or as the Chinese were for centuries, we will in fact have a despot without any limits ruling over us. But normally in history, you have a tension that gets resolved. The example I like to point to is actually the First Reich. We're talking about the Third Reich here, but let's talk about the First Reich too, namely the Holy Roman Empire, which lasted basically 1,000 years. And there you had different kings, you had the emperor, you had princes, you had dukes, you had peasants, you had tradesmen, you had all these different strata. You had the three estates that met. The king couldn't just levy tax, he had to get the permission of the estates. So in reality, what you have is simply the, you might say, the conflict of forces between the different factions of society. But the difference, though, being that it's not just a every man for himself situation like we're evolving into in our country, but rather all of those estates were still realizing that they're part of the whole. And so, for example, the estate of the free cities or the estate of the nobility, they would try to meet the king's demand to raise the money, but only among their own ranks. So the nobility could only raise the money within their ranks. The clergy could only raise the money within their ranks. the towns within their rank and so forth. So you had a very beautiful system where everybody was trying, basically pulling toward the same end, but yet there was a little bit of a push and pull and diversity there, which prevented just any one party turning into, a lawless despot. So I think that's the model we have to have. I mean, rather than just thinking that by setting up a rule, like, we'll only let them do what the Bible says.
Right.
I mean, they're only going to do that as long as they want to, if there's not a culture and a people that are behind that, giving teeth to it.
Right.
So, you know, one thing that I've realized is that this is the fallacy with constitutionalism also. You know, people think that, you know, if we could just put a constitutional amendment in to prohibit abortion, then it would end. Well, no, it wouldn't, because we're ruled by men that use words however they want them to be used.
That's right.
I mean, where did anybody read the right for abortion in the current existing constitution? And if that's crazy, why would putting an amendment in help matters? Same with homosexual marriage. So, in other words, once a people goes crazy, there's no remedy. It doesn't matter if you have the Bible. It doesn't matter if you have the Constitution. Nothing matters at that point.
Good point.
So I think the answer is simply that we have to become a real people again. And where the despot can't become a despot because... just by kind of the nature of what the society is.
Question in the chat room from Neil Desperandum related to our current subtopic of theonomic libertarianism. He says, I remember Tom saying one time that a theonomic Christian living in Nazi Germany would have supported the regime. I'd like to hear him expand on that if possible.
Well, one thing that I've tried to point out also is that people always ask, you know, like, would you have been a National Socialist or, things like that. And the first thing we have to point out there is that, the problem of personal identity when you have tried to abstract your person and put it in a totally different culture, different language, different culture, history, different literature. You know, if I was living in Germany, would I also have German parents? Would I have been learning Goethe rather than Shakespeare? At the end of the day, am I the same person once you add all those factors in? But nevertheless, I think if we kind of like, instead of asking that, like, what would I do, since the problem of personal identity is a difficult one, instead we should just ask, you know, what would someone that kind of sees the world like we do, basically conservative, tribally based, Christian, limited government, what would someone with that general profile of views think during 1930s Germany? And there it's a slam dunk. I mean, it's obvious that the vast majority of them did support National Socialism. I don't know if there was ever more than maybe 30-50% that, you know, were registered with the party and so forth. But there was a vast number beyond that that were glad that it was happening and fellow travelers, you might say. I mean, even... for crying out loud, even the philosopher Heidegger joined the party.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I was accosted by a Republican congressman at the coffee shop here locally. And when I said I didn't vote anymore, he gave the spiel about how, I met some Germans and they said that, that was what led to the rise of Nazism. You know, it's people just not caring, not voting. And, you know, it's that always that same bugaboo gets dragged out. And I wanted to tell him, you know, listen, sucker, first of all, tell me the names of the Germans you've actually met. I think you're bluffing. But secondly, you know, look around this room. It's a fairly conservative part of the country. Probably 60% to 80% of the people sitting in this coffee shop would all have voted for the National Socialists. So, I mean, if you think just registering to vote and voting is going to prevent some great evil, that's ridiculous. Not to mention the fact that, what do you mean this is a great evil?
Yes. I'm hearing from people in the chat room that there apparently is a user limit to how many people can get in this free chat I'm using on tribaltheocrat.com. So if you want to, if you're on Skype, you can friend me at New Christendom, and I will throw you into a Skype chat, and you can ask a question there. This is Tribal
Theocrat. Maybe they could email you, too, or something.
Sure. This is Tribal Theocrat Live. My guest is Tom Hingest. We're discussing National Socialism and Third Reich issues, and we'll turn the corner now and get into the the war, World War II, Germany invaded Poland, and most people cite this event as the beginning of the war. What was Germany's motivation for doing this, and were they the just party?
Well, yeah, I mean, as invasions go, this was one of the most justified in the history of warfare. I mean, so I would model it somewhere in the range. At best, it was fully justified. At worst, it was no worse than what we find in any war anywhere. The situation there was two things. First of all, Poland itself was a creation of the Allies in the aftermath of World War I. If you look at a map of Europe during World War I, Poland didn't even exist. And this is actually, if we can take a slight digression, just to kind of like backfill on that a bit, this was one of the things that made me a tribalist in my view of world history, because it was always upsetting to me that the borders of Eastern Europe, especially, but all of Europe, you know, if you kind of like drew a picture of Europe every 10 years and then flipped them one of those cartoon stacks of cards, you know, they're jostling around and jiggling and shrinking and growing and shifting left, shifting right, going up and down, sometimes part of this country. But what stays the same is the Polish people. The Polish people have always been there, but Poland usually hasn't even been there as a political entity. Usually it's been part of either Russia or the Holy Roman Empire. So at one point it was dominated by the Swedes. At a time it was under Brandenburg. So Poland itself didn't even exist as a political entity, and much of the land that the Allies created for it in Versailles was basically stolen from Germany. So a lot of the territory of Poland itself was historical German territory.
Right.
But the real crux of the problem was that the Allies, in the course of splitting that up, had divided East Prussia from the rest of Germany so that they were no longer even contiguous. So you basically had East Prussia sort of like Alaska is for us. It was like an outpost out there. And the Germans, in between those two outposts was the city of Danzig, which was another historically German city, Reichsstadt. So the Germans very reasonably asked for a corridor. They felt, I think, completely reasonably that there should be a corridor that connects, by which they can travel back and forth to East Prussia by land and not have to get on a ship and go out there to their own country. And this, in the course of jostling between nations, this is among the most reasonable of all that can be imagined in history. And the Poles, no doubt, would have worked out a deal under those terms, had it not been for the French and British, who had made promises that if they got molested by anybody, specifically by Germany, or England and France would interfere on their behalf. So this stiffened the Poles into a very unreasonable position. And it was doubly unreasonable because the French and British had no troops there. There was nothing they could do about it anyway. So it was all a horrible tragedy in that sense. The other thing that I have to constantly remind people about is that within a week or two of when Germany went into Poland, the Soviets went into Poland from the other side and scooped up their half. Now that had been kind of worked out secretly, the von Ribbentrop deal. But for some reason, nobody says that our future ally, the USSR, started World War II by invading Poland. You have to ask, why is that?
Right. That is a good question. Well, who or what were Germany's main enemies? I have been told by my public school teacher, freedom, democracy, the American way, non-Aryans, brown people. Who were the enemies?
Their main enemy was communists, both the Bolshevists in the USSR and, you know, the traitors to the German people that became communists within their own land. Now, quick sidebar on that, though, many of the German workers that were seduced by communism were able to be convinced to come over to National Socialism. So, you know, among the National Socialists were many former communists that had been talked to and explained that, look, we are also for the worker, but we are for the German worker, not just this abstraction of the workers of the world. And once they kind of understood the terms of the debate, they readily came over. But you also have, you know, the fellow traveler, the hardened, basically servant of Satan, you might say, who's just wants destruction, wants chaos and destruction. And so those communists had to be basically suppressed. And then you had the Bolshevik revolution and USSR looming in the East. And one thing Americans don't realize in our kind of cushy, privileged position over here is that, you know, the Bolshevik threat was one that struck terror into the hearts of just about everybody in the world except for Americans and British because of our island status, you know, and being so far removed from it. But, you know, they hardly ever mention in the school treatment of the rise of Nazism that pretty much most of the Eastern European countries were allies of Germany because they saw Germany as their great hope for preventing the complete inundation of their own countries by Bolshevism. So it wasn't that they necessarily were fellow fascists or, you know, wanted to help the Germans and the German recovery. They were in it for themselves too, but they saw the great enemy as communism. And ironically enough, you know, we allied ourselves with USSR. And then as a result of the war, we entered into a Cold War that lasted 50 years with the people that Hitler was trying to put out of commission. I mean, there's just so many ironies in this whole story. So as a result of Hitler supposedly, you know, wants to take over the world, which we can talk about, it's a falsehood also. But as a result of that, the Soviet Union did take over all of Europe, except for that small sliver known as Western Europe, and held it for 50 years.
Interesting. Question from the chat room, if you don't mind. This is from Matthew. I read that Hitler was funded by Rothschild. Is there any truth to that? Was Hitler a puppet in the same way today's politicians are? Was he used to stir up hatred against the white race? Any thoughts?
I've heard that sort of allegation also. You see, one of the problems is that, first of all, I'm not aware of any direct corroborating evidence of that. If your reader has like actual documentation, I'd love to see it and analyze it. But one thing I've noticed is that pretty much any claim whatsoever can be made about Hitler. He was financed by this. He was allied with that. He actually was a homosexual. You could say anything about him and get away with it because he's such a pariah. In other words, nobody's going to really come to Hitler's defense no matter what you say. Mm-hmm. When I just look at the man, when I look at, you know, his speeches, what he told the people, how the people responded to him, I just find that hard to believe at a kind of a gut level, that he was actually just kind of a pawn of a Jewish conspiracy or something. I don't know what more to, sometimes you just have to go by your gut, you know.
Yes, I understand. Did the...
The fact that we have to look at not only Hitler and his rhetoric itself, but also how people responded to him. And would a guy that's actually trying to destroy them have been able to generate that type of love? I just kind of doubt it.
That's a really good point. He was quite a popular guy. I forget what the total vote numbers were when they were voting on whether to give him these plenary powers, but it was over 80% of the vote.
Well, that's right. And not only that, but you look at the film clips of, you know, when he would like ride, make public appearances, you know, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people out there.
Yeah.
Just as far as the eye can see, just a mass of bodies. And is he surrounded by, you know, bulletproof shields and, Secret Service men with Tommy guns? No, he's standing up in a convertible driving slowly through the streets.
That's a great point.
So it's almost unbelievable when you actually start looking into this more deeply and actually looking at the documentation with a critical mind. It's almost amazing how opposite it is to the impressions that we've gotten from our, controlled media.
Indeed. It seems that everything the establishment tells us, you can pretty much bank on that being the opposite of the case. Did the United States have a just role in this war? Surely one can't sit by and idly amid these German atrocities.
Yeah, well, there's so many layers to that we could probably spend the rest of the time just on that. But, first of all, as far as the alleged atrocities,
right.
one thing I try to point out, even apart from the factual question of the atrocities, they played no role whatsoever in either Britain or America's entry into the war. So when you look at the speeches by Roosevelt and Churchill and so forth, now Churchill did try to demonize, you know, the Nazis, he would always say, right, the barbarians bringing darkness over Europe. But, you know, this was all just playing on sort of British anti-Teutonic mythology more than anything factual. There was no mention even in his book, as far as I know, of the death camps or anything like that. So none of that played any role in America's involvement. We have to need to get clear about that. So even if it turns out that the atrocities are factual, which we'll probably get into later, but in that case, it would be kind of like, let's say you go to rob a bank, and when you get there, another robber has beat you to the punch. And so you pull your gun out and kill the guy that's already robbing the bank. And then suddenly, you know, you're treated as a hero by the town. Killed the bank robber.
Right.
Well, yeah, but you were actually secretly, your goal was to rob the bank too, and you just got, you know, lucky on that one.
That's a good analogy.
That's the first thing. The second thing is that as far as what America should have done, I think that there could be even a case why we should have entered the war as an ally of Germany to defeat our common threat of the USSR. But if you want to take at the furthest left position you want to take, like say toward theonomic libertarianism, then we should have just remained neutral, like Sweden and Ireland did, and Switzerland and many other decent countries. We should have just remained neutral and let them fight it out. And without our intervention, the Germans would have won both World War I and II. We didn't even need to ally with them. All we needed to do was not send millions of men and millions of dollars of armaments over there. Yeah, I wanted to add another point to the first chat room question.
Sure, go ahead.
You know, like, would we or would people like us have been National Socialists? It kind of reminds me of the story of Paul Schneider, who was a German Reformed minister who got in trouble with the National Socialists and so forth. And that's a story that'd be worth talking about, but I want to just focus on one aspect of the story right now. When he started to become persecuted by some of the local Nazi leadership, his church, he was in a kind of a rural village out near the Rhineland-Pfalz region. His church members in the village wrote a petition or something and signed them, most of the church members, saying, look, we have defeated the communists at great personal cost, you know, fighting them in the streets. And if you don't let this guy go, let him, you know, get off his case, we're going to resign from the SA. And it just kind of struck me as one of those little oblique little factoids. But think about it. That means that these people in an evangelical believing Reformed church in a village out in the sticks, farmers and tradesmen and so forth, they were basically members of the SA who had helped to fight the communists by hand. And it was the majority of his church. So the idea that it was like a pagan organization, I mean, there probably were many pagans there in it as well. In fact, we know there were.
Sure.
Schneider got into some trouble with that local group. But nevertheless, it also included evangelical Christians who were not just politicos, but working as farmers and villagers. So it's just kind of like a little oblique little cast of light that kind of... Yeah,
that's very helpful. Well, here's the section I think most people are wanting to get into. Truth or fiction regarding the Third Reich? I'll throw some issues at you, and if you know the answers, we can discuss it. First one, eugenics. Did Hitler have these cruel programs so many people talk about?
Well, Well, first of all, let me preface this by saying that, you know, after I've seen how many lies have been told about the Third Reich, I've kind of got the posture that even things that I think are true, I hold with tentativeness until right. A real historian that's honest, which we have very few, you know, can properly sift the documentation. Nevertheless, it does appear that there's evidence, at least circumstantial evidence, that a program of euthanasia of handicapped severely retarded children did did start up in 1939 and went for a year or two. And this would certainly be a problematic aspect of the Reich, naturally. However, to put it in a little bit of perspective, we need to point out a few things. One is that there were eugenics programs in America also. Now, it probably didn't involve euthanasia. But, for example, Virginia, starting, I think, in the 20s and going into the 70s, did involuntary sterilization of retarded people. And there were other states in the, in America that did that as well. So the concept of eugenics, if you kind of take that as a broad umbrella category, was a problem for the West in the way of thinking on both sides of the Atlantic, you know, throughout the world. So we have to be a little bit slow before we cast the first stone. The other thing that's striking about the German case is that it was very secretive. Again, assuming it was true, and which I think it probably was, it was very secretive. And once word leaked out to the public that this was happening, the outcry was so great that it was shut down. The operation was shut down. The way it came about, according to the BBC documentary, was actually a father that had written to the chancellery asking if his, basically with a severely handicapped child, basically asking if he could be euthanized. And that letter was intercepted by one of Hitler's underlings, one of the Minifuhrers underneath him at the chancellery, who basically started the program on his own behest. It does appear as though Hitler knew about it and approved of it, although to what extent he approved of it and like how far it went, it'd be another question. So, you know, one thing is that we do want to not become party advocates on the other side. Where there were evils that took place, we need to be willing to own up to those and point them out. So this would possibly be a blight that would be. But there again, you know, the question is, does that invalidate the whole society because of that incident that took place for a 1 or 2 year period, which was shut down when the public found out about it? Well, I don't think so, any more than, like, say, the Waco massacre or the American government's pushback against Christian education back in the 70s and things like that completely invalidates our society. In other words, it was an evil. It was one that was remedied. And, you know, we don't want to sweep it under the rug, but we also don't want to act like this was, like, the central theme of the movement.
Fair enough. Well, the next one is probably the most popular question being asked right now. You see this thrown around everywhere in light of the Sandy Hook shootings, and that is, did Nazi Germany take away firearms from its citizens? I read this all the time. Even LouRockwell.com, these guys are supposed to be professional truth tellers and somewhat historical revisionists, but they always say things like, we don't want to become like Nazi Germany, so we need to fight back and argue for our gun rights.
That's right. Even Gary North just last week on LouRockwell.com made exactly such a reference. Right. And it's usually via this weird group, Jews for Handgun Ownership or whatever it's called. You know, it's almost like Gentiles need to find a Jew to advocate their position to give it credibility. You know, it's kind of an amazing kind of thing. However, Gary North at least did have the honesty to say that it was a revision of a gun law that had been passed by the Weimar Republic.
Yeah.
For some reason, that's never mentioned by the when this concept is used. I know that there's information that you might want to talk about also, but also just to set the stage a little bit to understand the situation. Remember that under the Versailles Treaty, not only were the German citizens disarmed, the German military was disarmed. So during the 20s, you know, there was a strict numerical number to the maximum number of police and military men that there could be. And one thing that really brought this home to me, if you watch Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will documentary, they show this workers' corps. I forget what it's called, but it's a corps of workmen. Hundreds of thousands, well, like on the order of 100,000 of these men in uniform marching. They look just like soldiers in every way, except that instead of rifles on their shoulder, they have shovels. And that was because Versailles had, you know, forbidden arming even even of men in uniform, basically. Yes. So the struggle was the opposite of what people are thinking. The struggle of National Socialism was to rearm the German people, not to disarm them.
Right.
It was the Allies that had disarmed them.
Good point. Yeah, the gun laws that were on the books at the time Hitler took over were a lot more stringent than the ones that he instituted. In fact, I understand that in the Weimar Republic, you couldn't even own you had to have a permit. Is this right? A permit for a rifle. And under Hitler's regime, you did not need a permit for a rifle. And
well, that's right. I mean, so the National Socialist legislation of 1938 was a lessening, an amelioration of the earlier law.
Right.
So in other words, the only criticism that you could make was that it wasn't a complete, free-for-all,
right,
libertarian opening up the floodgates of, but to the extent that it was anything, it was relaxing the strictures that had been put down under Weimar. And, you know, the thrust of National Socialism was not to disarm the people, but to re-energize them, including arm them appropriately so that they could resist their enemies. Now, of course, when you have insurgents and agents working for your destruction, you don't want to open the floodgate and just let guns pour into their hands. So you have to also kind of understand maybe some of the tension that they felt at that time, where they didn't want to just go completely libertarian all at once.
And when the so-called American liberators came after World War II, it was the Americans, not Hitler, that literally disarmed the Germans by taking their firearms, looting some in the houses, and making them turn them in. So the Americans are the ones to blame for disarming the Germans, not Hitler.
Yeah, and the thing that's especially amazing about that is that the Americans were, the Germans are fairly compliant people to authority. So when they made that demand, the Germans lined up to turn in their guns, and they were amazed at how widespread and how many firearms the Germans owned.
Everybody had guns.
Yeah. So you see these lines with, men with, guns and swords and different weapons, bristling in their little felt to carrying cases,
yeah,
ready to turn into the American authorities.
I'm sure they had a few buried in the backyard.
I guess in the Soviet occupied regions, you'd be shot on sight if you were found with even a cartridge.
Yeah. How about that? Yeah.
Our great ally.
What about banning homeschool? I'm a huge homeschool advocate, certainly no fan of the public school system. Did Hitler ban homeschooling, to your knowledge?
I don't know. I don't. It's an argument from silence to say I haven't seen any such documentation, because you can't prove a negative, right?
Right.
But I guess I wanted to kind of like try to, when we find out what the answer to that is, to try to like set the stage for how to think about it. First of all, let's also compare the American situation. Back at that time, homeschooling was not really a common concept, and I don't think in either side of the Atlantic. So I think at the end of the day, the answer is going to be it was a moot point, because nobody was really pushing for that. But let's start by just looking at the Christian school education. In America, you had the fundamentalists basically fully behind the public school system. And it wasn't really until Rush Dooney and the pushback during the 70s that fundamentalists very noisily discovered Christian education at all. And, just one example from my own reading, Lorraine Bentner wrote that book on Roman Catholicism. And Lorraine Bentner is kind of like the arch right-wing reactionary reformed hardliner type of guy.
Right.
But he was sneering and mocking the Roman Catholics for starting their own schools. And they were saying, why should they have the right to do that when they could go to our nice public schools? And that was kind of the attitude at that time. And it was not only pro-public school, but, looking suspiciously and with hostility toward anyone that would want to break away from the public school system. And that included the fundamentalist Presbyterians and fundamentalists in general of that period. Now, it did not include the Lutherans and the Dutch Reformed. When they came over, they just quietly, without anybody making a big stink about it, formed their own schools. And so, you know, when the fundamentalists discovered Christian schools in the 70s, they read books and press conferences, and it was a big deal. The Lutherans and Dutch Reformed had been doing it all along, very quietly. Well, now let's flash over to Germany, the situation there. There you had the state schools also, the, you know, government schools, whatever you want to call them. But there you had a portion of the day that was set aside for catechism, where the parsons, you know, either Roman Catholic or evangelical would come in and basically catechize the children. So you almost had a government school that was hybridized with the Christian school concept, partly because of they don't have the notion of the separation of church and state that we have. So in a sense, you could almost say their public schools were quote-unquote Christian. Now, how good the instruction was and so forth, that's a different question. But it would have been good where the parsons were good, and it would have been bad when the parsons were bad. That's the answer to that. The other point that I would make is that, you know, frankly, homeschooling is not the panacea that some people think it is. Now, I'm sure it is in your case, but I've run into homeschool groups that basically idolize Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes.
And, you know, they do a big thing to celebrate the day and praise him. And not only that, but they were in one town. Some friends of mine linked to my articles that I published on Martin Luther King. And those homeschooling mothers just hit the ceiling. I'm telling you, they just hit the ceiling to see Martin Luther King criticized this way. Now, if you think about it, any government, let's say you had a decent government, not an evil one like ours is, but a normal good government. If homeschooling was basically a training ground for commandos under the guise of homeschooling, training to kill the king and take over the government, naturally that government would crack down on it. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is common sense. So in a sense, I almost think that if our Führer ever arises, he's going to have to basically shut down homeschooling temporarily until these mothers that are going crazy can be reeducated, because it's not going to do any good to have homeschooled children that are being raised to become traitors to their own people, like is what's happening right now.
Yeah.
So kind of the position I've come to now is that this is a very relative concept. You know, sometimes extreme methods have to be taken temporarily. In a ideal society, you would have free markets, and you would have homeschooling, and you would have largely parental total control. But when you're in a situation where everything is falling apart at the seams, you might have to temporarily not have a free market, not have homeschooling, not have a variety of different things. I mean, the first thing our Führer should do is just shut down all the TV stations, for example.
Agreed.
Get this garbage out of people's hearts and minds and homes. But that doesn't mean that in the long run you would keep it that way. So, you know, to kind of wrap it up, I mean, I'm not aware of any crackdown on homeschooling, but I guess at this point I'm almost willing to say that if there was, there probably was a good reason for it.
What about
at least it's possible that there was.
Okay. Oh, very good. What about the banning of Christian holidays? I think I read your old colleague on the site said something to the effect of, I could be paraphrasing here, Hitler's, the worst thing he did was to ban Christian holidays. That was probably an overstatement, but do you know?
It's actually not even believable, because the Germans practically invented Christmas, quite frankly. I mean, I'm a strong regulative principle guy, but I'm coming now to a notion of Christmas as a civil holiday. But the beauty and the attraction of that we see in Christmas is basically a complete German invention, with the tree, the decorated trees, the singing of carols, the glitter, the stars, the angels. This is in the German blood, and no dictator, left, right, up or down, could possibly eliminate that from German culture, even if they wanted to. So it doesn't have any prima facie plausibility, that claim.
I'm not sure where I got that. Sorry if I was wrongly attributing that to your colleague, but I forget where I picked that up.
Oh, to my colleague?
Yeah, I thought it was on your blog where your colleague was interacting with somebody in a comment section a few years ago, and there was a statement, the worst thing he did was to outlaw Christian holidays, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I think that you're probably wrong, because, first of all, the Roman Catholics were a vital faction of his constituency, especially in southern Germany.
Okay.
And going to give up holidays. I mean, it's part of their canon law.
Yeah.
You can't give that up any more than you could give up the Pope and still be in Roman Catholic. And then the Protestants with their Lutheranism, Luther having brought the Christmas tree in and everything, it doesn't make any sense. It wouldn't be possible. However, having said that, what I did learn from the study of Paul Schneider is that what got him in trouble was that some young punk Nazi pagan, you know, or maybe the way to say it is a pagan that happened to be a member of the National Socialist Party, started trying to convert the celebration of Christmas in the school, de-emphasizing the Christian aspect of it and emphasizing the mystical German aspects of it. So he realized that we got to keep Christmas because it's part of the German blood, but he did try to paganize it by kind of taking it back to the more mythological aspects and not wanting to mention the Christian aspects. Now, Paul Schneider, who was the village pastor and I think sort of the headmaster, brought church discipline against this young punk for doing this. And it was exactly at that point, bringing church discipline, that he got in trouble with the party. But I don't see that that was a national program. My view is that it was probably something that broke out here and there with, again, the pagans that happened to latch onto National Socialism. And Schneider got in trouble because of exercising church discipline against a German peasant, was the way the charge was framed. Well, there again, Americans that don't believe in church discipline have no right to throw a stone here. We do because we believe in church discipline. We can criticize what happened at that point. But most Americans can't because they also don't think the church has any right to meddle, quote unquote.
This is Tribal Theocrat Live, guest Tom Hingest talking about National Socialism, Third Reich issues. We're going to ask a few more questions. It's amazing, Tom. You and I were talking before the show that we weren't sure if we'd get a half an hour. Here it is, almost 90 minutes.
Well, we probably should try to do a wrap. Because we don't want to put everybody to sleep.
That's true. Let me ask you about... No discussion of this topic is complete without a Holocaust question or two. I won't fully address the plausibility of the official account. You have a wonderful post on your blog called the Prima Facie Case for Holocaust Research, I believe. But I just wondered about this issue that David Irving brought up, and he takes the stance that while there's no documentary evidence proving that Hitler knew of the Final Solution, that he believes that Himmler himself was running this operation on a much smaller scale, but behind Hitler's back. Have you found any cooperation of this?
Well, I haven't, but then again, I'm not the type of trained historian that would be required to investigate that type of documentation, nor even an amateur historian of the type of level of David Irving. I heard him speak a couple of years ago where he also mentioned that same point. And at that point, I asked him in the question and answer period, I asked him if he'd ever seen the documentary that you can watch online called One Third of the Holocaust, which pokes holes in the whole Operation Reinhardt death camps in a very powerful way. And Irving admitted that that was a very good documentary and raised some questions that, are hard to answer. But he thought that from his examination of some of the archives, he still holds to the fact that there was some sort of death camp operation going on under Himmler's. Now, my own sense coming out of that meeting was that he was not really running on all eight cylinders in his answer, because he didn't grapple with the specific points of the one third of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to understand, he was thrown into the slammer in Austria, I think with solitary confinement and so forth and so on. He was basically a broken man for a while coming out of that. And he only got out early because he conceded that homicidal execution of Jews had taken place. That was the basis for him letting him get out of jail early. Think about that for a speech that he had made 17 years earlier. He was arrested and thrown in the slammer when he went into Austria.
It's incredible.
So, you know, he's there. You have to kind of think of the psychology that he's operating under. I mean, he's had to kind of, like, as it were, take an oath that, okay, there were death camps, you know, just to not die in a stupid, moldy jail cell in Austria.
Right.
And so this is going to be playing on him. I don't want to accuse him of fabricating the truth, because I don't think he's an honest man. But I think that there is a psychological tension in his mind because of that immediate background. And it has not been accepted by some of the worldwide revisionists like Faurisson and others. So I'm skeptical.
Yeah.
I guess the thing that, at the end of the day, the thing that makes me very skeptical of the death camps in general, besides, you know, numerous things that I mentioned in that article, I would direct the listeners to look at that article. It's on firstword.us, because it raises questions that I'd like you to grapple with and maybe engage the discussion with. But, you know, one of the fatal flaws, I think, of the whole death camp notion to me is that, besides the lying and contradictory witnesses, the fact that there's such scant evidence, and so forth and so on, it's just the stupidity of the whole operation.
Yeah.
You know, if you were out to commit a genocide against a 6 million strong contingent of people, you would not go to all that trouble of railroad cars and camps and showers and haircuts and all this nonsense. You
would diesel engines.
You would march them off into the woods and put a single 38 or 9mm slug into the back of the head after making them dig the hole that they're going to drop into. So it just doesn't make sense. You know, I mean, in other words, paint the Nazis as wickedly and most vicious as you want to. Nobody should accuse them of being that stupid.
I agree. You've written a lot about Dresden on your blog, The Bombing of Dresden, and you've done so with notable passion. Can you take just a moment to give our listeners a high-level history of the bombing of Dresden that they didn't get in public school?
Well, Dresden was a historical capital of Saxony. It's on the Elbe River, and it was a city that was known as the Florence of the Elbe, meaning not only was it a repository of artwork and statuary and other, you know, fine culture, but the city itself was a work of art. It was like a jewel of a city with timber frame houses and great, magnificent buildings, and the opera, the Semper Opera, and the bridges over the river. Just a charming, beautiful, yet large city. And it had been set aside as a hospital town, so it had no military significance whatsoever. It had become, for that reason, a destination point for the refugees that were pouring out of the former Reichland just ahead of the Red Army as it swept eastward. So the city had swollen to over 1 million people, with refugees sleeping in the parks, sleeping in railroad cars in the railroad station, and so forth and so on. And the Allies, Bomber Harris, under the British Air Command, ordered its bombing on February 13th, 1945. Now, you have to remember that by that time, the war was over in everything but name. The Soviets were already knocking at the door of Berlin. The Americans were in Europe. There was absolutely no reason, even if this had been a military impregnated fortified city, to attack it. But they did. And it was basically a horrific napalm attack that sent the whole city up in a smoldering smokestack. And some people are trying to argue the death toll down to like 30,000. Irving, I believe, puts it closer to 300,000 that died. It was carnival. It was the by the way, this is another oblique little thing on the Christian holiday question that just occurred to me. Carnival is a day in the Christian calendar celebrated by Catholics, but also, I guess, high Protestants sometimes, just before Lent. It's the, kind of the kickoff of Lent. I think it's Mardi Gras here in our country. So the children were dressed up in costumes for the carnival celebration. So much for having a banned Christian holidays. And they were, you know, incinerated. Pretty much all of the sane commentators, for example, even Paul Johnson, admit that this was a ethical blight on the Allied effort. But I think it's very emblematic. One of the aspects that I found particularly horrifying, I don't know if you noticed the news article just a week or two ago about that lunatic up in Michigan who set his house on fire, but he was waiting in ambush, and when the firemen arrived, he opened fire and shot at them. And just how sickeningly cruel that kind of behavior is. You know, imagine setting a fire and then ambushing the men that are coming to put it out. Well, this is exactly what the British did to Dresden. They set the city on fire, and it turned into a smoke. Now, unlike what probably would happen if an American city was hit like that, where you'd have a traffic jam of people fleeing the city, what happened in Germany was you had a traffic jam of people coming from the neighboring cities into Dresden to try to help. I mean, this itself, and again, you have all these little oblique little tidbits that kind of paint a picture, like one little sentence tells you about a whole people. But anyway, so you had the roads jammed with trucks trying to get into Dresden with rescue supplies to help them. And Bomber Harris, knowing this would be the case, he timed a second strike just at that moment when the rescue workers would be at their peak.
Horrible.
Just as insane and murderous as that lunatic in Michigan that waited in ambush for the firemen to arrive.
Was that Michigan or New Jersey?
I thought it was Michigan, but okay. I could be wrong. No, I think it was actually New York. It was near Rochester, New York.
Okay.
It's a suburb kind of north and east of Rochester along the Lake Erie up there. Now, actually, you know, I have a book by A.C. Grayling, who's I think he's an atheist, but he's a prominent philosopher that wrote a book called Among the Dead Cities. And it's a very good book. I would recommend it to your listeners. But he has a section in the back of that book, an appendix, where he just lists all of the bombing raids on German cities. And it's like 50 pages long, a fine print. You know, for a while I was going to do probably more like 30 pages, but I was going to do a blog sequence where every day I would just make a notice of the city that was bombed on that day and try to just go through it over a 2-year period. But I finally gave up because it would be too much work.
Sure.
The bombing in 43, in July of 43, of Hamburg was even worse than Dresden. So Dresden is really, we mentioned Dresden just because it's kind of like doubly sickening when you read about it, because not only was it the napalming of helpless women and children, largely, in hospitals, but it was with absolutely no strategic significance or tactical significance whatsoever. And so that's what kind of, it becomes kind of a paradigmatic case, but it's actually, we could talk about many other cities, Hamburg being the first one under Operation Gomorrah, which was the first firestorm. Literally a tornado or hurricane was set up of fire. And it was basically applying napalm to civilians.
Wow. Really?
Don't seem to realize. You know, some of us are horrified when we see the pictures of the napalming of the forests in Vietnam. This was far worse because it was napalming cities directly.
Just horrible. Sickening. And, of course, the United States government carries forth this same system. We think about the drone bombings. I think it was the Monday before the Sandy Hook shootings, Obama orders some drone attacks on civilians in Libya. Just horrible.
Oh, yeah. It is horrible. Yeah, the Americans in World War II, the American Air Force has slightly less bloody hands than the British do. In that we flew during the day, whereas they flew at night. And they flew at night because they were targeting the cities, which could be spotted at night. We flew during the day and usually had specifically military targets in mind. However, our hands are not really clean at all there either, because even in Dresden, the next morning, there were surviving civilians on the banks, huddled on the banks of the Elbe River, and American Mustangs came over. You can almost imagine the refugees waving, you know, like, we need help, and they were strafed by the American fighters.
And, of course, back to the Holocaust question, many of the people that did die in these prison camps died because the British and U.S. were bombing food supplies.
That's right. I mean, it's hard. It's really hard for us to imagine the devastation. I mean, you have to think of every city in America that has, like, say, 50,000 people or more being reduced to rubble. Literally every single one.
It's unfathomable.
It's unfathomable. I mean, I don't think we would survive as a people.
Wow.
It's almost miraculous that they were able to bounce back and rebuild so with so much pluck after all that.
Well, in conclusion, Tom, how do we move forward as a Christian people, a once Christian nation? Is it as easy as having a Fuhrer come to rise? We've got 72% white, 16% Hispanic, 12% black. This isn't a nation anymore. It's not an ethno-state. What are some steps to take? How do we get back to sanity?
I know. Well, me and my colleague have argued about this because my colleague thinks that it's too far gone, that there's nothing that can be done to restore us as a nation. I still hold out the hope because I think that, you know, at least in the broad swath of America that includes the Old South, the Midwest, and the Upper West, you know, the non-coastal Northwest, you're talking about millions of people that still do value freedom and our inherited culture. Mm-hmm. And although it's waning, you know, with the media influence, especially, we're becoming a nation of couch potatoes, but I still hold out the hope that there's something there that could be tapped into. Now, as far as the lack of the ethno-state, I think a lot of that could be solved fairly easily. I think the Mexicans would go back to Mexico if we became an ethno-state again, mm-hmm. pretty much peacefully and non-violently. I think the Jewish problem could be dealt with, you know, if, you know, just by force of numbers, we can deal with that problem and get our country back. What to do in the short run? Certainly don't think that by going to a voting booth and pulling a lever, we're gonna vote our way out of this. That's the first crazy thing that we have to get out of our blood system. It took me a long time. It took me lots of arguments and. But as my colleague says, you know, the American elections are basically theater. It's basically like street theater. You know, you get two major candidates, both of which have been carefully groomed and approved by the
yes
behind the throne, and then this whole illusion of arguing and debating and fighting back and forth and strategizing, it's all just an illusion. It's all a theater.
We get to choose between Marxist A and Marxist B.
Excuse me, what's that?
So we get to choose between Marxist A and Marxist B.
Well, that's right. I mean, or the way I said it on this election, you know, an illegal alien from Kenya or a man who thinks that Martians copulate and have offspring, one of which was God.
Those were our choices a few months ago. Amazing.
And then you look at the way the Republican Party treated Ron Paul. And, you know, Ron Paul has got a lot of problems from a nationalist point of view, but yet he was a huge breath of fresh air and would have done a tremendous amount of good.
Certainly.
And I think he could have, you know, to the extent that the elections aren't rigged, so this is a big, big if, I think he could have defeated Obama. But he was just treated completely shabbily by not only the mainstream media, that goes without saying, but even the Republican Party. So, I mean, anybody that thinks that, you know, if we could just rally with the Republican Party, you know, they have to be insane. Now, on the other side, to be fair, you know, I watched this guy named Ramsey Paul from time to time on has a YouTube blog that he puts yep. videos up. And he has argued fairly persuasively as a nationalist that we should get into the Republican Party and sort of take it over from the ground roots up and so forth. My own view, though, is that you know, the deck is stacked from the beginning because we don't control our own media. We have no way to get the message out to our own people. And therein lies the problem.
Yeah, the media is a huge, huge problem. So many people are addicted to it.
We do. I mean, all individuals can do is, well, first of all, unplug the TV.
Yeah.
You know, cancel the cable. Get that mind. You know, I found that if I go a year or two without watching TV and then I'm traveling and staying in a hotel and I flip on the TV.
It's shocking, isn't it?
It's shocking. Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, you develop spiritual calluses when you're immersed in it. And then, you know, after a couple of years, those calluses start to turn tender again. And then all of a sudden, it's like, I can't believe this. They're showing this on TV. And even the blasphemy now, it's creeping in.
Yeah. It's amazing. We chucked our TV several years ago, and I think it was about, it's been a while since I've had a TV. And a year ago, or a year and a half ago, I joined a gymnasium to get in shape. And as you're on the treadmill, they have these TVs in front of you. You can't escape it. You cannot escape a TV unless you look straight down. And the stuff that comes through on these cable channels is near pornographic, Tom.
I know. Yeah, and you can't even go to McDonald's without having a TV now.
It's bad.
Everywhere. But anyway, you mentioned the gym to make a different point, but that was almost like the second point I was going to make. I mean, start getting in shape. You know, I'll take the first hit for being kind of a pudgy couch potato, but I'm trying to turn that around. We need to be, if a leader ever does arise, we need to be fit, manly men. And so get rid of the TV, start exercising, start reading, and then trying to influence, you know, people you bump into at the restaurant or at the bars, your family, your friends, very gently though. You have to go, go very slowly.
Absolutely.
That's pretty... when you have somebody over, you know, for coffee or something, then say, oh, by the way, I've just been watching this documentary, One Third of a Holocaust. Let me show you like 10 minutes of it.
Yeah.
Whatever. Trying to influence that way. We need to become good churchmen, setting the example of being good churchmen, and also trying to, you know, find people to kind of overlap in our point of view a little bit and helping to encourage them and solidify them a bit. The thing I would advise against is kind of like taking the campaign to your church, because that's a mistake of numbers, I feel, where you kind of think, well, if I could just bring these 100 people over, you're doing a lot of good. Well, you're not going to be able to bring those 100 people over. Instead, you should let the wider community be your stage and try to just influence, you know, one or two people here in your family, one or two people there among your wider circle of friends, kind of just proceed more gradually there. I think we just have to pray that our leader will rise up and that, you know, can galvanize us and let us kind of re-galvanize as a people and re-solidify as a people. It's in God's hands, ultimately.
It is. I think it's very good advice, and I've learned a lot from this interview tonight. I want to thank you for your time, Tom, and I've enjoyed it thoroughly. I hope it's been a benefit to everyone else. Thank you for those who participated in the live chat room and to all the listeners. And if you're listening by podcast, if you enjoyed the show, please send it to a friend and do the same with our other podcasts as well. And remember that Monday we're going to be doing another broadcast with John Friend. We'll be talking about media psyops, a very interesting show. And until then, we'll see you next time at Tribal Theocrat Live. Thank you.